Blog Talk Radio.
Mid-sized feedlot in an industry now dominated by mega feedlots.
such as those owned by the world's largest beef packer, JBS Brazil, with a one-ton capacity of over 900,000 cattle, or the other mega-feed lot that also feeds hundreds of thousands of cattle at a time. It is owned by the second-largest beef packer, Cargill, or the other handful of mega-feed lots with capacities of hundreds of thousands of cattle, such as those owned by Cactus Feeders Incorporated and Friona Industries. In comments submitted to the U.S. Department of Justice, RCAF USA estimated the above-named mega-feed lots feed 18% of the nation's feed cattle each year, with one-fourth of the nation's cattle are fed in feedlots with a one-ton capacity of 50,000 head or more. The largest of feedlots are getting larger, and Calicrate's feedlot is among the group of small to mid-sized feedlots that are being pressured to exit the industry so beef packers and corporate feedlot owners can increase their respective capacities. Data from the U.S. Agricultural Department shows that 45 feedlots with one-time capacities of between 1,000 or more cattle, but less than 16,000 cattle, have exited the industry from 2008 to 2010. RCAF USA contends beef packers are deliberately forcing small to mid-sized feedlots out of business through unfair and abusive cattle buying practices that effectively restrict market access to all but the largest of feedlots. The proposed GPSA rule,
USDA Grain Inspection Packers and Stockyard Administration rule,
will put a stop to such unfair and abusive practices, but only if the USA issues a final rule, said Calicrate. Calicrate's feedlot is a perfect example. In late 1998, the nation's largest beef packer blackballed Calicrate because he called attention to the unfair buying practice of the corporate meat packers. Calicrate was forced to cease his feedlot operations until 2000 when he opened Ranch Foods Direct, a meat processing and distributing company in Colorado Springs, Colorado, and began marketing his own beef more directly to consumers. I believe the EPA's enforcement action is premeditated effort by the EPA to partner with the beef packers to finish the job the beef packers couldn't do alone, said Calicrate, adding, along with my feedlot, the EPA has filed enforcement actions against five other smaller feedlots, including one with only 400 cattle. Calicrate said the EPA does not appear to be going after the corporate feedlots. The EPA is turning a blind eye toward the mega feedlots that are at real risk for pollution. Instead, is antagonizing small to mid-sized family operations in an effort to help their packer partners capture the entire live cattle supply chain away from the family farm and ranch operations. We thought the Obama administration was going to bring about a change to the ongoing corporate control and corporate dominance that is decimating the U.S. cattle industry. I guess we're going to see the change. I guess we're seeing the change right now. Rather than reduce corporate control and dominance, the EPA is overtly partnering with the corporate beef packers to accelerate the exodus of sustainable, independent family operations. This really smells, Calicrate concluded.
And that's, and you can go to R-Calv. C-A-L-F USA for that one.
Calf.
C-A-L-F. Okay. For that one, and check that out. There's a whole lot of other things on there. But they want to, they're making hay a pollutant now. So much for that. I thought that was interesting. There's a little bit of news on Palestine, and I wanted to, this is a few minutes long. But Palestinians are about ready to do a march, okay, for their own state, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And,
go ahead.
Yeah, so that's just
Palestinians prepare. preparing to march in support of a bid for statehood at the UN later this month could face more than they bargained for. Israel has given security forces in West Bank settlements a license to shoot at protesters. Organizers insist the rallies will be peaceful and will not approach settler homes, but Israel says it's preparing for every eventuality. Well, let's now get more from our correspondent, Paula Clear. So, Paula, is this is giving this authorization more likely to make events spin out of control, you think?
Well, that certainly is the concern on the ground. I mean, already now in some quarters there is talk of a third intifada that some will say will be as bloody and as violent as the first two. Settlers, of whom there are some 400,000 living in a land that has some 2.5 million Palestinians in the West Bank, are bracing themselves for violence, as is the Israeli army and the Israeli police. Now, for several months, the Israeli army has been preparing in an operation it calls Operation Summer Seas, and it's now in the final stages of putting the finishing touches in place. To this end, we're being told that they have demarcated a red line around every settlement in the West Bank, and what this means is that Palestinians who approach further beyond that red line will be shot at by soldiers who will have permission to do this. Now, there also has been intensive training in terms of security groups within these settlements. They have been participating in drills that the army has been undergoing. They've been provided with stun grenades, with water cannons, as well as with tear gas canisters. We're also being told that some $20 million has been spent on training the police alone, that 28,000 police officers have been mobilized around the country. One of the focal points that they'll be watching is Jerusalem, which is where many fear most of the violence could erupt.
Well, it seems like Israel has been more focused on the Palestinian drive for statehood than its own internal problems. Is that so?
Well, certainly that is one of the criticisms that's being leveled at the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. On Saturday, we saw the largest protest in this country's history, where some 400,000 demonstrators took to the streets of 10 cities. Here in Tel Aviv was one of the focal points. A number of speakers, a number of artists addressed the crowd. They spoke about making history. They said really that this was a turning point in the history of this country. What protesters have been demanding for the better part of 2 months is social issue justice. Really what they're saying is that the Netanyahu government needs to be less focused on issues of security and more focused on internal problems, problems such as the high cost of living in this country. And this is a criticism that Netanyahu is facing, a criticism that he is spending too much time on issues on the international agenda rather than addressing real domestic concerns here at home. Just this past weekend, Turkey expelled the Israeli ambassador and froze all military cooperation between both countries. The relationship between Israel and Egypt is at an all-time low after Israeli fire mistakenly killed a number of Egyptian border guards. So with that kind of regional isolation, and certainly in the context that it's just several weeks before Palestinians will be appealing to the UN for recognizing their unilateral declaration of statehood, there is a lot of concern that what is happening on the international stage is really becoming an excuse for the Netanyahu government not to address real concerns that people have here. I mean, talking to protesters, they accuse Netanyahu of being passive, of being unresponsible, and of being out of touch with what people in Israel are concerned about.
So there you go. That's what's going on in Israel right now as they prepare for the statehood of Palestine. They're not about to give that up, but without a war. But maybe it's time. Maybe it's time. There was, I wanted to touch on a couple of things tonight. There's one here that I thought I should show.
A third of Europeans have mental illness.
Right. Yeah. A third of all Europeans have mental illness. And very bizarre here, but, probably wouldn't surprise me if based on the conditions they're living under right now, especially in Great Britain.
Mm-hmm.
Others were ready to get rioting and austerity measures and on a high unemployment. Very similar to the United States, actually.
Yeah.
College of
Neuropsychopharmacology, ENCP, says a third of the European population suffers from a mental or neurological disorders each year. Researchers say some 38% of two in five of Europeans suffer psychological problems such as depression, anxiety, insomnia, or neurological disease like Parkinson's and dementia. The study, which covered 30 countries, including 20 CEU members, showed that just about 165 million of the European mental patients are receiving treatment, and mental illness is becoming a major socioeconomic problem, as most of these people could not be employed and their personal relationships are broken down. Mental disorders have become Europe's largest health challenge of the 21st century, said co-author Hans-Ulrich Wittgenstein of Germany's Dresden University. The most frequent disorders were anxiety disorders with 14%, insomnia with 7%, and major depression with 6.9%. In attention deficit and hyperactivity disorders in young people accounted for 5% of the problems, while 1% of those aged 60 to 65 and 30% of elders aged 85 and more suffered from dementia. Findings suggested that the overall rate of mental problems was almost similar between men and women, but women were around 2.5 times more likely to suffer depression, particularly during the childbearing age, while men were likely to become alcohol dependent. While rates are thought to be increasing compared with 2005, overall rates of depression in women have risen since the 1970s and are now about double, probably due to changes in social patterns. Researchers also expressed concern about the early onset of mental disorders as people in their teens are the youngest to be diagnosed with anxiety, and about 90% of anxiety disorders are first diagnosed before the age of 18. Findings uncovered a lack of treatment for mental disorders. The immense treatment gap for mental disorders has to be closed, Wittgenstein warned. Those few receiving treatment do so with considerable delays of an average of several years and really with the appropriate state-of-the-art therapies.
So, just thought I'd bring that up to you.
And what magazine was that from, or newspaper?
That was from the
Press TV.
Yeah, Press TV. Okay. And there's just a couple more here on the health issues that I wanted to bring up before I go to the something else here. This isn't a health issue, but in a way it is. It's a banking issue. I'd like to bring that one up before we go into the bank, after we go into the banking thing, but I wanted to
talk about this one on marijuana.
That's really not that good.
The first part of it was. But anyway, this is the one on children being heavy.
Yeah. This one here.
Perverse effects of technology on children.
Yeah, that's good. It's an interesting article.
Henry Matkov.
Past decade has seen a profound increase in use of entertainment technology by children, some as young as age one. And developmental delays, obesity, attention deficit, and learning disabilities are now the norm. This is by Chris Rowan. A research review regarding the impact of technology, its video games, iPods, and smartphones on child development, behavior, and academic performance. Infants watch 2.5 hours per day of TV, 25% of TVs in their bedrooms. Children use 7.5 hours per day of entertainment technology, 75% have a device. 30% of children will enter kindergarten developmentally delayed. 14.3% of children have been diagnosed with a mental illness. 25% of children are obese. 25%, wow. 30% of children require special education assistance. All right, so impact statement. Attachment to technology is detaching children from humanity, which, with consequent increased childhood psychological and behavioral disorders accompanied by prescription of dangerous psychotropic medication. Media violence has now been categorized as a public health risk due to causal links to child aggression. Brain development research shows that the technology overuse by children result in pruning tracts to the frontal cortex, adversely affecting executive functioning and impulse control. In early studies now indicate electromagnetic radiation emitted from technology is harmful to adult physical and mental health, with no studies to date on children. Schools continue to escalate use of educational technology without any research evidence to show efficiency or safety. It is now time to manage balance between activity and knowledge. All right? Technology use overview. This goes on a ways, but getting the point. In 2006, Canadian study reported 1 in 6 children have a developmental disability, with only 55 to 65% of developmental disabilities are detected prior to school age. Data from 88 show that reported 17% of U.S. children a developmental disability, with 6% of child population having language impairment, 8% a learning disability, 7% ADHD, 5% autism, and with 13.2% assessing special ed. Now it's way up to 30%. Wow. What's going on, Lana?
I have no idea.
Developing children require 3 to 4 hours per day of active rough and tumble play to achieve adequate stimulation to the vestibular proprioceptive and tactile sensory systems. Scottish study reports toddlers aged 3 years engaged in only 20 minutes per day of moderate to vigorous physical activity, which correlated with a decline in total energy expenditure and sedentary behavior. Studies identified TV, video games, strollers, and the culprits. Human detachment and psychological disorders. Children who watch more than the expert recommended 1 to 2 hours per day of technology have a 60% increase in psychological disorders. Wow. Nationwide survey reports problematic use of video games was associated with lower scores on life satisfaction and with elevated levels of anxiety and depression. That was a study in 2011. And parents who stay in touch with their university-aged children, usually using social networking, text, email, Facebook, have children who are more anxious, lonely, and who indicate loneliness, anxious attachments, as well as conflict within the parental relationship, than children whose parents stay in touch by phone. What'd you think of that?
I don't know about that.
No.
I'd like to know what they use to measure that.
I don't know. I don't care. It's bad. It's bad. Okay. What's about time? I wanted to go to this story here. And this is our special feature tonight, where I wanted to talk about the Civil War erupts on Wall Street as reality. Civil War erupts on Wall Street as reality finally hits the financial elite. They start turning on each other.
Mm-hmm. Finally, after trillions in the fraudulent activity, trillions in bailouts, trillions in printed money, billions in political bribing, and billions in bonuses, the criminal cartel members on Wall Street are beginning to get what they deserve. As the Eurozone is coming apart at the seams, as the U.S. economy grinds to a halt, the financial elite is starting to turn on each other. The losses are piling up fast. Here's an extensive roundup.
As I reported, up, this shocking, huge $196 billion lawsuit, right, against 17 major banks on behalf of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Bank of America is severely exposed in this lawsuit. As the parent company of Countrywide and Merrill Lynch, they are on the hook for $57.4 billion.
In losses.
Yeah, in J.P. Morgan is next in line fire with $33 billion, and many death-spiraling European banks are facing billions in losses as well. Right? And FHA files this, and here's just some of the places that are being sued.
Allied Financial, $6 billion.
Bank of America Corp, $6
billion. Barclays Bank, $4.9 billion.
Citigroup, $3.5 billion.
Countrywide Financial Corporation, $26.6 billion.
And Credit Suisse Holdings, $14.1
billion. Deutsche Bank, $14.2 billion.
Right. First Horizon National Corp, $883 million.
General Electric Company, $549 million.
Goldman Sachs and Company, $11.1 billion.
North America Holdings, $6.2 billion.
HSBC, right?
Whatever
yeah,
that
6 point.
Is.
That's a European actually. Morgan. $2 billion. J.P. Morgan Chase, $33 billion. Merrill Lynch and Company, First Franklin Financial, $24.8 billion.
Morgan Stanley, $10.6 billion. Nomura Holdings America Incorporated, $2 billion.
Royal Bank of Scotland Group, $30.4 billion.
Societe Generale, $1.3 billion.
Right.
The complaints were filed in federal court or state court in New York or the federal court in Connecticut. The complainants seek damages and civil penalties under the Securities Act of 1933, similar in content to the complaint of the FHFA filed against UBS Americas Incorporated on July 27, 2011. In addition, each complainant seeks compensatory damages for negligent misrepresentation. Certain complainants also allege state securities law violations or common law fraud.
Right. And there's a whole list here of the different lawsuits that are going on. But right now I just wanted to
go to the audio.
I wanted to go to the audio of a couple of these. This is a little segment by
Mark
Matt Taibbi. Okay, he's a writer for the Rolling Stone, and it's about 10 minutes, but he talks about his article. He's done a lot of research on this and how the SEC is covering up for Wall Street, covering up all these crimes, as well as, and then this one I wanted to put, this is about Bloomberg's discovery, and then we have, and there's another one here by Banks Got Money for Free, which is really very good. So we're going to go to those right now and play one after the other.
Okay.
So hang on to your hats, folks. This is enlightening.
Securities and Exchange Commission covering up Wall Street crimes. That's the question examined in an explosive new report by Rolling Stone reporter Matt Taibbi. He begins the piece, quote, "Imagine a world in which a man who's repeatedly investigated for a string of serious crimes but never prosecuted has a slate white clean every time the cops fail to make a case." Taibbi argues this is exactly how the Securities and Exchange Commission has been treating the Wall Street bankers who helped cause the ongoing global economic crisis. Matt Taibbi joins us now, political reporter at Rolling Stone magazine. His latest piece, again, is the SEC covering up Wall Street crimes. How are they doing it, Matt?
Well, the SEC had a number of different levels of investigation. They had a thing called a MUI, which is a matter under inquiry, and this is basically any preliminary investigation, any tip that came in from a whistleblower or from a self-regulating organization like the stock exchange or FINRA, if they suspicious trades, anything like that. If they investigated and they did not get permission from the people up above in the SEC to proceed to a full-blown investigation, they then shredded all that evidence they gathered in the preliminary stage. So they destroyed all the evidence of all MUIs dating back to 1993, and that might be as many as 18,000 cases.
Under whose authority?
Under the authority of the Enforcement Division. Now, there's no legal authority to do this, and apparently, according to my sources, this was illegal. You can't just unilaterally shred any government document, no matter how insignificant, and these are significant law enforcement investigatory files that they were unilaterally destroying.
Talk about just what the SEC does, the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Well, they police the financial markets. They're the main cops on the beat on Wall Street. It's basically a two-tiered structure. It's You know, for Wall Street crime, it's the SEC and the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York are the two main sort of policing organizations that prevent things like insider trading, market manipulation, securities fraud. They also make sure that all publicly traded corporations, they have to make regular disclosures, you know, every year, and they make sure that those disclosures are accurate, that you don't have an Enron situation, for instance, where a company is reporting profits that they don't have and hiding losses that they do have. The SEC is supposed to be the number one cop and to be preventing all this stuff. And if they're not doing their job, which they apparently haven't been, you know, what results is a situation like 2008 where just corruption overwhelms the markets and you have this explosion of, you know, a lack of confidence all around the globe.
Who is the whistleblower who started to expose what was taking place?
His name is Darcy Flynn. He's a 13-year veteran of the SEC. He had a variety of positions in the SEC, but most recently he's an attorney who worked, and part of his responsibilities were to maintain the records within the agency. Now, when he took this new job in 2010, he discovered this policy that the SEC had been destroying all of its preliminary investigations, and he was, you know, understandably upset, and he started this whole process of coming forward. He contacted the National Archives to because he wanted guidance on the issue, and he only came forward publicly because he couldn't get reassurances from the SEC that they wouldn't take action against him for coming forward, and so that's why he came forward.
Senator Grassley said the files include important cases such as the investigation of Bernie Madoff, Goldman Sachs trading in AIG credit default swaps in 2009, financial fraud at Wells Fargo and Bank of America in 2007 and 2008, and insider trading investigations at Deutsche Bank, Lehman Brothers, SAC Capital.
Yeah, no, one of the criticisms of my article after it came out was, well, you know, all of these cases, these movies that got destroyed, they were insignificant cases. That's why they didn't proceed to full-blown investigations in the first place. Well, we know that this isn't true. We know that at least a couple of these cases involved Bernie Madoff in the years before the Madoff story came out. Also, Darcy Flynn, this whistleblower, he also came forward with revelations about his own experience as an investigator. One of the first cases that he talked about was one where he was trying to pursue a case involving Deutsche Bank, a very promising securities fraud case, but it was rejected by the chief of the enforcement division, who shortly thereafter took a job as the general counsel of Deutsche Bank. So we know that this is part of the culture at the SEC. There's a whole problem where there's this dichotomy. There's the lower level investigators who are sort of career bureaucrats, they're more like cops, basically, and the guys on the upper level are more like political appointees who come from all these high-priced Wall Street banks, and they're rejecting a lot of these important cases.
Peter Henning, who writes White Collar Watch for Deal Book at the New York Times, wrote yesterday, although Matt Taibbi and Rolling Stone described the policy as Orwellian, the practice looks more like corner cutting to avoid cumbersome federal regulations on document disposal, the very type of conduct that the SEC often criticizes companies for when it pursues an enforcement action. And he goes on to say the actual document destruction, which ended last year, probably had no significant effect on any continuing investigations because it only applies to inquiries dropped earlier.
Yeah, I mean, that's just preposterous. I mean, I don't know how. Ed, can you imagine if the DEA, for instance, destroyed the files on 18,000 cases of drug enforcement? How could anybody seriously argue that this wouldn't have an effect on ongoing investigations? Every, you know, law enforcement these days is increasingly dependent upon this intelligence-based model of enforcement where you piece together bits of information from all kinds of investigations and you identify patterns that grow over time. So if you have a company, and there were a number of these companies like Lehman Brothers and AIG and Goldman Sachs that had multiple complaints against them in the last 10 years, if you're an investigator and you don't have the opportunity to go back and look at those cases and see what patterns might have been there or not been there, I don't know how you can say that that doesn't have a serious effect on all enforcement.
Is this going to stop?
Well, they have stopped the policy of shredding the files. Last year, after Darcy Flynn came forward, they did adjust the policy. But the thing that was really troubling about that is that when he came forward, and brought this to the attention of the people in the enforcement division, they did not immediately admit it and admit the problem to the National Archives. They tried to cover it up, and so we know that the culture problem at the SEC that caused this in the first place is still there. It's still the same people who are running the SEC, the same bad instincts that got us to this place in the first place are still a problem.
Let me ask you about our headline today about Obama administration reportedly putting increasing pressure on New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman to agree to a broad state settlement with banks over questionable foreclosure tactics. The federal settlement has been widely criticized because it would insulate the nation's largest banks, including Bank of America, Citigroup, JP Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, from all criminal investigations in exchange for civil fines. Schneiderman and others have opposed the settlement because they say it would restrict their ability to investigate and prosecute wrongdoing in a variety of areas, including the bundling of loans and mortgage securities. Matt Taibbi.
Yeah, no, this whole issue of securitization was central to the cause of the financial crisis. All of the banks, not just a few of them, all of them were engaged in this wide-scale fraud scheme to take worthless and or extremely risky subprime mortgages and sell them as AAA-rated investments to unsuspecting investors all over the world, including, you know, pension funds here in the United States and foreigners in Scandinavia, China, Saudi Arabia. Basically, this is a fraud scheme where you're selling garbage as gold, and they were all engaged in this fraud scheme. They all knew that they were selling extremely risky stuff as AAA-rated investments. And the Schneiderman investigation is targeting the root of this process, the securitization process, where they took the subprime mortgages and chopped them up and then waved their magic pixie dust on it to turn it into AAA-rated investments. The national deal is seeking to cover this up and try to insulate all the banks from liability, especially civil liability, for what they did. If they do that, then they're going to get away with this, and we're not really going to fix the problem. And I think Schneiderman is really the only law enforcement official out there right now who is seriously trying to uncover this mess.
Let me get to two other headlines. One is Lloyd Blankfein, head of Goldman Sachs, now retaining a top lawyer known for defending Enron defendants. His name, Reid Weingarten.
Yeah, no, Goldman's now stock price has now plummeted to 104, which is unbelievable. It was, you know, in the 160s just earlier this year, and I think this news that Blankfein has retained Weingarten is a serious indication that they're expecting serious prosecution.
And Devin Sherman stepping down as head of Standard & Poor's.
Well, I mean, I think, I don't know what to make of that. I do know that Standard & Poor's and Moody's and all these ratings agencies are going to come under increased scrutiny for their role in creating the financial crisis after they downgrade the United States. I think it's time to start taking a look at them again.
Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone, thanks so much for being with us and for your reporting.
You.
That does it for today's broadcast.
That was a Democracy Now! Report. That's very good. But the next one I have coming up is from Bloomberg. It's Wall Street Pentagon Papers, or Part 3, Are the Federal Reserve's Crimes Still Too Big to Comprehend?
Yeah.
Another day, another trillion plus in secret Federal Reserve bailouts revealed. Bloomberg News exposes this latest Fed deal after winning a long Freedom of Information Act legal battle to get the details on what was done with the American people's money. Their report runs with an AMFED status style headline. Wall Street aristocracy got $1.2 trillion from Fred. And the aristocracy is alive and well, thanks to the Fed, of course. Keep in mind, this $1.2 trillion is in addition to those $16 trillion the government accountability audit revealed, and the over $2 trillion in quantitative easing the Fed dished out, not to mention the now continued promise of the zero interest rate policy. This is also separate from the $700 billion TARP program that Congress approved. This is yet another unknown secret program, throwing another mere $1.2 trillion in public money at the Wall Street elite, global banking cartel, just being revealed now.
Those of us paying attention over the past 3 years have had have had Fred crony capitalism on steroids fatigue for a while now. Nonetheless, this is deja vu all over again as another mind-boggling, huge story that must be covered and comes to light. Here are some of the details, or here are the details of the latest revolution.
It's just mind-boggling how much money. And for people have to understand when they get into this that this is
our money.
This is our money. This is American taxpayer money being thrown at these banks and these corporations and these world countries and everybody else at zero interest.
As your standard of living is plummeting and prices here are going up.
And they're worried
about
a deficit. What deficit? You know,
there is no deficit.
You know, if the Fed can make up all this money anywhere, then he can give money to everybody in this country. It could pay off all the debts. It could do everything and everything.
But it wants to keep you
and me
enslaved.
That's right.
That's all it is.
But when you hear this report,
you'll be
just
sick.
Understand that for every dollar that was given out, that's $1 that you, the taxpayer, owe the Federal Reserve. And all of a sudden, the Federal Reserve decides to print trillions of dollars. Trillions.
On your back.
The Fed. That they're just throwing out and expect the American taxpayer to pay for. All right? Now, this is really disgusting. So here we go.
I'd like to know who's okaying it.
Ben Bernanke.
Is he the new super president?
He's the new super president. That's right. Wait till you hear this, folks.
Make you sick.
Hopefully it'll play.
I wouldn't be surprised if they take it down.
No, it was very good. It should come up.
Takes a while, yes. Still coming up.
Sorry, folks. It didn't take this long before.
They probably took it down. Happens, folks, when something is really informative, it gets screwed with or it gets taken down.
Yeah.
Do you have another one? Or?
Yeah, there's one more. This really,
that was the creme
viewed,
de la creme.
I just viewed this last about not more than 2 hours ago. And it still says it's here, but for some reason it's not.
Well, play the other one, and then we'll come back to this one and see if it makes a difference. Banks got free money from the Fed. Let's listen to this one, then we'll go back to the other one.
This kind of explains what's going on the same way.
Now, let us turn to the Federal Reserve and the money that they gave out to the banks during the great calamity of 2008. Now, actually, between 2007 and 2010, they gave away a combined $9 trillion in loans, okay? Now, those loans were so small in terms of the return they were getting. Sometimes it was as low as 0.0078. Basically, it's free money. You have to understand something that's very important here, because it's not just that, hey, you get up a loan and then, you know, you get the loan back and then so everything's fine. No, if you give loans in that degree with that kind of low interest rate, you're basically giving away free money. Imagine if I gave you $1 trillion. And then I said, okay, you can then sell it back to the government at 3%, right, as an example for Treasury bonds. And by the way, 3% was the lowest they ever got. Okay, let's do some quick math on this. Let's see if I can do this. Yeah, that'd be free $30 billion that you would get in a year. Do you understand that? It's not just that you're getting a loan that you can do something else with. It's a free $30 billion that you hand to any bank if you give them $1 trillion, as an example. And a lot of times it's a lot more than that. They get more than 3% interest rate. So who do they give it to? How do they give it to? Let me give you one more number. $1.2 trillion is the maximum amount on December 5th of 2008 that the Fed had taken out, because they're circulating it. They loan it, they bring it back, they loan it, they get it back. But at one point, $1.2 trillion was out the door, which is nearly twice as much money as we spent on TARP. So while everybody's fighting and arguing over TARP, Federal Reserve was like, who cares, man? We don't need no stinking Congress. We don't need a Treasury Department. We just take the money and we just give it to the banks and let them make all that tremendous free money so that we can shore up the economy. So which banks got it? Take a look at this. They gave it to nearly 300 institutions, but here were some of the biggest recipients. Bank of America, $91.4 billion. Goldman Sachs, $69 billion. J.P. Morgan Chase, $68.6 billion. What happened? I thought Jamie Dimon was a genius and he didn't need any money. So why did he borrow over $68 billion from us? Citigroup, $99.5 billion. Morgan Stanley, $107 billion. Okay, so that's the American banks. Well, what can we do? We had to save the American economy. That's their logic, okay? Well, how about the foreign banks? We didn't give to the foreign banks, did we? I mean, that's supposed to be the Federal Reserve of the United States of America. Well, we've told you in the past, not only did we give to many foreign banks, we even gave to Gaddafi's bank. But here, look, take a look at how big the numbers are for some of the foreign banks. Look at this. Royal Bank of Scotland, which sounds very un-American. Not that they're against it. They're a couple. They're certainly not American down in Scotland, or up in Scotland. $84.5 billion that they get. Credit Suisse Group gets $60.8 billion. Deutsche Bank, that doesn't sound very American either. That's, of course, German, gets $66 billion. So there you have it. Why are we printing money, giving it basically for free to foreign banks at insanely low rates, at insanely high amounts? Because we don't control the United States of America anymore. Multinational corporations and the top banks do. So our government represents Deutsche Bank a lot more than it represents the average American voter. By the way, what happened to us? We have over 13 million unemployed here in America, over 9% unemployment rate, 3 million homes foreclosed. Where was our bailout? Now, that's a lot of people. You know what? That sounds like that's so many people that it might be too big to fail. But nonetheless, we were allowed to fail. We were allowed to go under. We were allowed to go jobless. We didn't get any of that help. The big banks, no matter where they were, they got the bank, they got the help, because they're the ones who run the Federal Reserve. So this is all a giant joke on the rest of us. And you say, hey, you know what? People like Geithner always make an excuse. But we had to do it. What could we do? We had to give everything to the banks for free. Well, Dean Baker is one of the top economists and been on the program many times. Guy makes sense. Had this great quote. He said, this is the moment when you were giving that money away. This is the moment all the banks were on their backs. The Fed ran to the rescue and got nothing in return. See, that's the key part. Because Bernanke can come and say, hey, you know what, we had to do it, otherwise the whole financial system was going to collapse and all the world economies were going to collapse. Okay, so, but if you're going to give out that money, you know what you say? For example, no bonuses for you guys because you destroyed the world economy, and if I didn't lend you $100 billion, you were going to go under, and you destroyed your own banks. So the executives don't get bonuses. So the banks, when they make the money back, they don't keep it. They give it to the people that they borrowed the money from, the American people. Those are one of or two of many different conditions that they could have attached to this. They attached none of those conditions. One of the comical things is they say is, well, then the banks wouldn't have taken it. Oh, I'm sorry. Are you holding me hostage because of your incompetence? If I would have turned to Jamie Dimon, I would have said, you loser, here's what I got for you, okay? You either take the money and you take every single one of these conditions, including possibly breaking up your bank later because you screwed up the whole royal economy so badly, so royally, okay? If you don't take it, I go out to have a press conference and I say, hey, Jamie Dimon and John Mack and all and Lloyd Blankfein and all these guys who run the banks destroyed our world economy. And then when we were going to rescue them, they said no because they wanted to make more money and bonuses and salaries because they wanted to rob us blind. Go ahead. I dare you. I'm heading out to the press conference. You want to take the money or you don't want to take the money? Of course they were going to take the money. They were all going to go under if they didn't take the money. This is all a big joke, man. That's a ruse they play on the rest of us to try to pretend that they had to do it. They didn't have to give them all that free money. We got robbed. We got took. We've been had. I'm telling you the reality, man. That's what's going on.
Let's go back to the other one and see if we can get it to come up.
Yeah, it's still working. It's still trying. It must have been taken down.
Yep.
Because it's not there.
That's really
sorry,
sad.
Sorry, folks. Yeah, I'm really sorry. It kind of really screwed things up. I don't know if I can get it from. I go to Bloomberg. I don't know.
How long is it anyway?
It was 5 minutes. It was only 5 minutes long, but it was excellent. And just gonna try it one more time. Just go back, maybe something's screwing up. But the others played, so that
right immediately. So which makes you think somebody screwed with that one.
Yeah, I think they took it down. It was just too
inflammatory for them. The truth is always hard.
And because, I mean, it was real because they were showing what they found.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what they found.
Are you going to that?
Yeah, it's just coming up. It takes forever to come up. Hold on, folks. The system's fighting me. We have Pete Thompson, I don't know.
Yep. We'll have In the Ring with Woody at the top of the hour.
I want to do it. This would be a good one to do. Five worst so-called job creation ideas for the GOP. And these are ideas that were originated by the GOP, you know, for job creation. Okay. Republicans claim to have a job creation plan, but what they've actually got looks more like a job killing plan.
Well, I wouldn't doubt that.
All right. August 30th, Washington, nearly a year after the 2010 election, that was supposedly all about jobs, finally seemed that woken up to the fact that the economy is still in the dumps and Americans are sort of angry about it. Make that very angry. And with the Republicans in charge of at least part of the Congress, as well as many state governments, they know they're about to make some of the take some of the blame for the continuing lack of any policy ideas and job creation. Recent polls show only 24% of the country approves of how they're doing their jobs. Not to mention, the GOP primary field is loaded with contenders claiming that they have the magic solution for the jobs. All right? So what is the masterful GOP jobs agenda? You won't be shocked to hear that it's more of the same, more deregulation, more tax cuts, more whining about the deficits. House Republicans are planning votes for almost every week this fall in an effort to repeal environmental and labor requirements on business that they say have hampered growth, job growth. That says the Washington Post.
But since you're about to be hearing these same ideas with minor variations over and over again, we thought we'd count down the five worst ideas and arm you with some reasons why they're so very bad. Union busting. Labor Day seems to be the locus for all of those job agendas. Obama's promised his after Labor Day, and GO presidential candidates seem to be gearing up for that date as well. But they seem to have missed the point of the holiday, that is, if their agendas are to be believed. The House GOP has taken aim at organized labor as well as Obama's National Labor Relations Board, and we know that right-wing governors around the country have been
slashing public sector union jobs as part of their misguided austerity agenda.
The Republican Party would like nothing more than to break organized labor completely. Introducing an agenda around Labor Day would just be a nasty little bonus. The Washington Post reports that Eric Cantor plans to try to overrule an National Labor Relations Board ruling that keeps airline manufacturer Boeing from transferring its assembly line to South Carolina from Washington State, where union workers have gone on strike four times since 1989 over things like excessive overtime, safety precautions, and health care benefits. South Carolina is a so-called right-to-work state where the workers would be non-union and paid less. As Josh Edelson wrote, it's the latest round in a decades-long labor struggle. At stake, do workers at Boeing get to shape their own future in Boeing's, or they just have to embrace, or rather submit, to the corporation's plan? Union workers make more money, have more job security and better benefits, and thus contribute more to the economy. Now, no one is denying that South Carolina's workers need jobs. The GOP siding with Boeing isn't about its deep desire to employ South Carolinians. It's about corporate Asians' ability to be able to pack up and move to wherever the labor costs people are cheapest, with little regard for the employees left behind. That's hardly a jobs agenda. And then on the House's agenda this winter, attacks on a rule proposed by the National Labor Relations Board that would streamline the elections process for unions, cutting down on the endless delays that they all too often stop an organizing drive in its tracks. This proposal was one of the quiet ways in which the Obama National Labor Relations Board was doing its job, protecting workers against the powerful companies they work for. Cantor and his crew want to go back to the days when corporations can endlessly delay union elections while spending money on anti-union propaganda. How is any of this job creation? It's just not.
I'll just read what they have, free trade agreements. They want free trade agreements so they can send your jobs overseas. Lowering business taxes, all right, and is the other way. And then there's a couple more here.
Repeal EPA regulations.
Yep, and cut the minimum wage. So these are the ways they think of it as job creation.
Ruin your life as an employee.
Yeah.
That's their idea.
Ruin your life, cut out your jobs, throw the jobs overseas, or throw them to low-paying wages. It's a wonderful world of the GOP.
Yeah.
A rotten hell. All right. Hang on a second. I got Woody Song.
Yeah.
Woody right up here.
Thank you, Lila. Good evening, sports fans. Watch your heads on the ropes as you step into the ring with Woody. Tonight's topics, well, I'm pretty much going to stick with the NFL with a little bit of baseball at the end, since the NFL season opens on Thursday. First off, Peyton Manning and his streak. The Indianapolis Colts on Monday addressed rumors about the halting progress of quarterback Peyton Manning's recovery from neck surgery. It seems his health issues now also include back problems. During the last week, the rate of improvement in Peyton's rehabilitation process slowed, the Colts said in a statement. Over the weekend, Peyton experienced soreness in his back. As a result of the most recent development, the doctors have decided that Peyton will not practice. His participation, therefore, in Sunday's game versus Houston will likely be doubtful. We will update his playing status as required by NFL policy as the week goes by. Now, the NFL's only four-time MVP, Manning, has started 227 consecutive games, including playoffs. Second only to that jerk of the year, Brett Favre, with 321 among quarterbacks. Unlike Favre, Manning has started from day one after being drafted first overall by the Indianapolis Colts in 1998. Obviously, when you look at it, it's been an incredible feat. He's been an Iron Man, said Colts Jim Caldwell. And obviously, it's doubtful that he'll play this weekend, but nevertheless, it takes a very unusual individual to put that kind of string together. Personally, I hope Manning starts this weekend. I can't stand Brett Favre, anything he's done, and certainly any of his records, so I'd love to see Manning shatter this record. The Colts have missed the postseason twice in Manning's 13-year tenure, including his rookie season. He has twice led the team to the Super Bowl, including a victory over my Bears after the 2006 season. According to Colts center Jeff Saturday, I hate it for Peyton. You want him to come back to be healthy. You want him to be back, but you want him to take care of it too. It's sad when players face tough times, but I know he's strong enough to get through it. If Manning can't play at Houston Texans in week one, the Colts will have to decide between starting recently signed veteran Kerry Collins and third-year player Curtis Painter. My opinion, they'll start Kerry Collins. Collins is an adequate backup. And that was pretty much a sign. When they signed him, that was pretty much a sign that Manning's progress had kind of slowed. So not too much of a surprise there. Okay. Tiki, not devastated, but I personally was elated. A Sports Illustrated report yesterday quoted Tiki Barber's agent, Mark Lefsetler, as saying he is flabbergasted that Tiki had not an opportunity with any team, especially when rosters were at 90 players this year. I certainly thought some team would be intrigued to see what he had left in the tank. The ESI reporter also added, I hear he's devastated that no team gave him a chance. Lefsetler countered that characterization. That is not correct, he said. I've never said he was devastated. The term never came out of my mouth. Yeah, right. The former Giants record-setting running back Barber, 36, hasn't played since 2006 and hoped to return to football this year, working himself into shape by going back to his rigid training regime. What many of you may or may not forget is this guy was pretty much a prick. He divided the New York Football Giants locker room. He thankfully retired, and what happened the next season? Oh, the Giants won the Super Bowl. Then Tiki thought he was going to be a big hit in TV. I think he went did something with NBC, thought he'd be this great reporter, this and that. That didn't work out all that well. Then he decided to start banging one of the interns that he was working at the TV studio with and divorced his then-pregnant wife at the time. And she whacked him for a lot of money on the divorce, so he thought it would be nice to go back to football. But, you know, he had to work out with the Dolphins. No other team took a look at him. Teams could be waiting until the first game of the season when contracts are no longer guaranteed, but it certainly could be the case that Barber will not get back into the league, which would be just great. I can't stand him. He's a little scumbag. This is the last I am speaking on this subject in any way, shape, or form. You can't worry about things in life you can't control, and Tiki has moved forward accordingly. That remains to be seen. Tiki seems to be somewhat confused when he can't do anything, you know, that he dominates in, and, you know, hopefully that'll be the last we hear of Tiki. That'll be the last time I'm speaking on the subject in any way, shape, or form, much like his agent. Okay. Now, the season starts on Thursday. I'm going to do what I do every year, pick the division winners. The NFC East, I'm going to take Philly. They've certainly loaded up, and they have a great quarterback with Vic. Hopefully the Giants will come in second place. Maybe they'll make the playoffs, but you know, that may or may not happen. In the Central, I begrudgingly pick the Green Bay Packers with the Bears coming in second place. Out in the West, I have San Francisco coming in second. I really don't care. This division's absolutely lousy out there. In the AFC East, I got the Patriots. Patriots weren't really supposed to be all that great last year, but they certainly proved that, you know, they're a team to be reckoned with, and they have more experience now and everything else. So you got to like them. The reason I picked them over the New York Jets, Jets, is because the Jets have a their second-tier quarterback is Mark Brunell. He's like 41 years old. He hasn't had a snap in quite some time. And if Sanchez gets banged up, can you really count on him to, you know, win any games or, you know, even be able to form on a, you know, for a half, even, you know what I mean? So that's why I put the Jets behind the Patriots, although they're pretty close neck and neck, and it'll be great to see them bang out again in the playoffs. In the Central, I have the Pittsburgh Steelers and Baltimore Ravens coming in a very close second. And on the West, I have Houston first, coming in first, with Indy coming in second. We'll just have to wait and see how that pans out. You know, Manning, I believe, is going to miss a couple games, and we'll see how thorough of a player Kerry Collins is with, you know, under that system, you know, with the Colts system. But, you know, many times you'll see that Peyton Manning has carried the Indianapolis Colts, you know, and they don't have a defense, and their receivers aren't that good, and he just kind of goes above and beyond. But, you know, we'll see what happens. That's why they play the games. So we'll just have to wait and see. Okay. Next up will be my Stone Cold Locks for the week. Now, on Thursday, we have the defending champion Green Bay Packers at home against the Saints. Now, the Packers are giving the Saints points. You got to like the Pack. They're at home. You know, the Saints are on the road. No dice. The Pack will win. So I'm taking the Pack minus -4. On Sunday, we have the New York Jets facing what everyone likes to call America's team. They're kind of like the drunk version of the NFL of the Red Sox. So I'm going to take the Jets at home minus -4.5 over the Cowboys. Cowboys just aren't a very good team this year, and we're certainly going to see that this first weekend. And I will, on Monday night, we have the Broncos at home against my Oakland Raiders. Raiders are getting 3, and I will take the 3 points. So I have the Packers at home minus -4, Jets at home minus -4.5, and the Raiders on the road plus +3. There you go for all you degenerate gamblers. my Stone Cold Locks of the Week. Now, last week, the New York Yankees traveled up to Fenway Park. Fenway and the Red Sox have been extremely unpleasant to the Yankees this year. They've certainly had their number. To me, one of the reasons that the Red Sox have had the Yankees' number is that every time the Red Sox have played the Yankees, Terry Francona has lined up his pitching, where his number one and number two guy, being Beckett and Lester, are always in the series, whereas Girardi just goes with whoever's up next. I mean, I don't know. That's just something I just, you know, kind of wonder about Girardi sometimes. But anyway, the Red Sox have had their numbers, and maybe it has nothing to do with who started and who didn't start or whatever. C.C. Sabathia won the first game, which was about time for him. He'd gone 0-4 against the Red Sox. The second game was a little bit more interesting. Phil Hughes, he was pitching for his life in the rotation, and he failed. He had the lead, lost the lead, and then had the lead again. You know, just, and it was just not a good showing for Phil Hughes. But who did have a good showing was in the rubber match was A.J. Burnett, the much beleaguered A.J. Burnett. Now, he was pitching for his life in the rotation as well. Burnett did only go 5 1/3, but he only gave up 2 runs. He pitched a strong game. It seems that maybe some of the mental stuff that's been bothering him has been worked out. According to some of the guys that were speaking during the Yankee broadcast, Al Leiter, for one, apparently had a nice long chat with Burnett, explaining to Burnett that you just go pitch by pitch. Don't let the enormity of the situation overwhelm you. Seems like, you know, he's overstimulized. You know, he thinks, you know, he has to win this game, and he has to go 7 innings, and he has to win in Fenway. And I guess all that was maybe kind of taken away, and he was just going pitch by pitch. Granted, he only went 5 1/3, but he did only give up 2 runs against, you know, what could be one of the best offenses in baseball, certainly one of the top three. So good for Burnett. You know, need to see more of that. He would have pitched today, obviously, but the, you know, rain delay, and, you know, it's still raining now in New York, so who knows if they're going to play the game or not. I keep checking, but, you know, no news yet. But that's good news for Burnett. I think he's, you know, solidified his role in the Yankee rotation. Phil Hughes, who's been in the bullpen before, goes back to the bullpen with some experience there, and with a great deal of success there as well. So for me, I think being a Yankee fan, I think it was a, you know, what I wanted to happen. If you put Burnett back in the bullpen, it would just be a nightmare. He's never been back there. He would take it as a big demotion, so on and so forth. Hughes, who's been back there, kind of knows what the deal is. And, you know, he's pitched some of his greatest baseball back there in that bullpen. So it's a plus for the Yankees. And, you know, we'll just have to wait and see. You know, maybe Brandt would be the third man in the playoffs. But, we'll have to wait and see. Obviously, Sabathia is going to be the number one guy. And, you know, frankly, I would put Nova number two right now, the rookie. Nova will be a great number two. So I think, you know, it's down to who's going to be the number three and the number four guy in the longer series. You know, is it going to be Colon? Is it going to be Garcia? Is it going to be Burnett? You know, as of a month ago, you would say Burnett's name would not even be in the conversation. But due to his showing, you know, in Fenway, which has been a house of horrors for him, you know, he's back in the conversation again. So good for him. About 25 games left for the end of the season, for this baseball season, and it's going to be down to the wire. Who's going to, win the division, the Yankees or the Red Sox? And I think it's going to be great, and the playoffs are going to be a lot of fun. So we'll just have to wait and see. And now football season's getting going. This is one of the best times of year, you know. You have a kickoff of football, and baseball's getting down to the wire. It's a great time of year to be any kind of sports fan. So we'll just have to wait and see how things turn out. So it's going to be some good stuff. That's it for this week. Shout out to all my woodheads out there: Ron, Mark, Leo, Dino, Troy, Greg at AFS, everyone at the Northeast Athletic Club, my partner, Money Mike. That's it for this week. Summer seems to be over, but let's hope for a little bit of an Indian summer. That's it for this week. Till next week.
And thank you, Woody. Let's play Woody's music. For this music. Yeah.
Because dangers of aspartame, the artificial sweetener.
No, it's in diet sodas and all kinds of things. They put, you know, they advertise foods that have low calories and no calories. They usually have aspartame in it.
It's all good out of even chewing gum, everything causes brain damage and brain cancer and all kinds of things. So let me go to this because it's about 10 minutes long, but I think it's extremely important. So hope you enjoy it. Sweetener is now being used in over 6,000 products. Independent research confirms aspartame is not safe. Aspartame can cause cancer, diabetes, obesity, headaches, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, ADHD.
You know it as NutraSweet. It's in just about everything. Soft drinks, iced tea, hot chocolate, tabletop sweeteners, chewing gum, cereal, pudding, ice cream, cookies, even breath mint and children's vitamins. Odds are, aspartame is part of your diet. But should it be?
It should be withdrawn from the market.
Look at this. A summary of nearly 10,000 complaints filed with the Food and Drug Administration since 1980 by people just like Edith Johnson.
I was horrified. I was panic-stricken. I was perspiring. I was scared to death on that night.
Edith says she'll never forget it.
Within a matter of moments, I went completely blind. I could not see anything.
Edith was drinking a cup of low-calorie hot chocolate that night. Aspartame made it sweet. And Johnson says aspartame made her sick.
All of a sudden, I couldn't see. My eyes went out of focus, and it was like my vision became quite blurred.
And you think it's because of aspartame?
I think it's very deliberately because of aspartame, yes.
It was terrifying. Kate Randall thought she was going crazy.
I started popping in my hands and twitching in my feet, my legs, my knees, my upper legs, and shoulders and arms and everywhere.
Like millions of Americans, Kate Randall was a Diet Coke drinker. A big one.
9 Diet Cokes a day.
For how long?
5 years. Every day. Every day.
Kate developed a twitch in her eye.
And then my chin, this part of my neck, and right up by my temples started to twitch.
Kate Randall went to several doctors, but their tests were negative.
The doctors told me that it was just a glitch in my system. My first reaction was, well, it's a glitch in my system that I'm not willing to live with. And what that meant was that I was going to do my own research.
So Kate went online searching for answers. And she says what she found left her with a bitter taste for NutraSweet.
I absolutely believe that it was the breakdown of my health for 2 years.
Kate Randall isn't the only one who believes NutraSweet is dangerous. Dozens of web pages warn against the ill effects of aspartame. One of them is supported by this man, Dr. H.J. Roberts, a private physician and author of several articles and books on aspartame.
Somebody has got to put this out and say, be careful.
Roberts calls aspartame an ignored epidemic. The internist says he's treated patients who suffered severe side effects from America's favorite artificial sweetener.
The bottom line is that I have over 1,300 in my own database that people have had terrible reactions to products containing aspartame.
Dr. Olney, do you think that aspartame should be on the market today?
No.
Why not?
Because it hasn't been demonstrated to be safe.
Dr. John Olney is a researcher at Washington University in St. Louis.
I fed aspartame to infant mice and found that it produced the same kind of brain damage that monosodium glutamate causes.
Dr. Olney started studying the effects of aspartame in 1970. He says he was alarmed when the rodents developed brain tumors.
It indicates that if there's an adverse effect, a serious adverse effect in the animals, and if that adverse effect is absolutely proven in the animal research, then it should not be approved for human use.
Dr. Olney took his findings to the Food and Drug Administration. At CERL, the company that developed aspartame, pushed to get the new sweetener to market. The FDA looked at the research, and in 1975, put aspartame's approval on hold. It set up an independent panel of doctors to study aspartame. In 1980, that public board of inquiry unanimously ruled aspartame should not go on the market.
We had a major responsibility to evaluate.
Dr. Vernon Young from MIT is the only surviving member of the Board of Inquiry.
Our conclusion was that on the basis of the evidence presented at that time, we weren't able to assure ourselves of the safety of aspartame in that particular context, and that we advised the need for additional studies.
We had some concerns about it and felt that there should be additional animal studies done before it was approved.
Dr. Jerry Goyen was the FDA commissioner then.
I looked at that, read it at the time, obviously, and said that, well, what we had to do next was set up an internal committee of people who had played no part in previous studies of aspartame.
But Goyen never had the chance to review the results. That's because he was forced to step down in 1981 when newly elected President Ronald Reagan appointed a new commissioner. That commissioner quickly approved the use of aspartame for dry foods like cookies and pudding mix. Just 2 years later, he okayed it for carbonated drinks. We tracked down that FDA commissioner, Dr. Arthur Hall Hayes.
Yes. My name is Aline Sardani with Class 5 in Washington.
Yes.
Can we ask you a few questions about aspartame?
FDA has all the information you need.
Yes, but sir, you were the FDA commissioner when aspartame was approved, and so we'd like to ask you a few questions.
No, I really have no comments. All the information is available to Food and Drug Administration.
Sir, don't you think it's your responsibility as the FDA commissioner when aspartame was approved to answer some of our questions?
Not now. I'm no longer commissioner of the FDA.
Do you think the public was
ever put at risk?
Sir, was the public ever put at risk? Sir, do you think he put the public at risk, sir?
Yes, I do.
Senator Howard Metzenbaum has his own concerns.
I can say that I was dissatisfied with the manner in which aspartame was approved.
So Senator Metzenbaum requested a review of the FDA's approval process.
I have a kind of recollection of it that sort of left a bad taste in my mouth. And it wasn't from aspartame.
To understand the senator's concerns, you have to realize what...
to study aspartame. In 1980, that public board of inquiry unanimously ruled aspartame should not go on the market.
We had a...
They have no comments. All the...
It wasn't from aspartame.
To understand the senator's concerns, you have to realize what this little blue packet is really worth. Searle sells millions of dollars of aspartame each year. It's used in nearly 6,000 products, including Diet Coke. Searle had a vested interest in keeping aspartame on the market, and the American public had a craving for a calorie-free sweetener.
It was a big public issue. It was a matter of considerable publicity and public attention.
Between my first and second seizures, I asked my neurologist about aspartame and a possible link to seizures.
The Senate's public hearings took place in 1987, but nothing came of Metzenbaum's worries. The committee decided not to request more studies and left aspartame on the market.
I think that there were a lot of politics involved in its being approved.
A lot of people share the senator's viewpoint. So Fox 5 obtained these campaign contribution records. They show that Searle made contributions to several senators involved in keeping aspartame on the market. Senator Howell Heflin received at least $5,000. Searle also contributed at least $3,000 to Senator Orrin Hatch. Senator Robert Byrd got $1,000. And Representative Henry Waxman also received a $1,000 contribution. And that's not all. We also learned that several federal officials were investigated for possible ties to Searle.
I think the chairman of the FDA wound up in having some sort of economic relationship beneficial to himself with Searle Manufacturing, who at that time owned the rights to aspartame.
The issue is really not an issue of science, it's an issue of politics.
The Monsanto webpage links sites belonging to the American Diabetes Association and the Multiple Sclerosis Foundation. Both organizations have published articles supporting NutraSweet. Monsanto does not mention its large contribution to both nonprofit groups.
Not enough is known about NutraSweet.
Edith Johnson, just wants the FDA to order more studies. So do the hundreds of people who continue to file complaints. So many. The Department of Health and Human Services has identified 91 symptoms by complainants attributed to aspartame use. The number one reported symptom is headache. Some of the other most reported symptoms are dizziness, mood changes, nausea, and stomach pain.
Absolutely. I think the FDA should revisit this issue.
But for now, the FDA has no plans to revisit the issue. The agency wouldn't even designate someone to speak with us on camera. But FDA officials did recently speak with members of the Aspartame Consumer Safety Network. James Turner and Mary Stoddard say they've been trying for years to convince the FDA that aspartame should be taken off the market, but their most recent attempt failed.
They barely acknowledge the possibility that some people may be harmed. Their basic position is that in everything they've looked at, all the data has come in, and there's nothing, zero, that suggests to them that there's any problem.
The Food and Drug Administration maintains aspartame is safe, but that's no comfort for Edith Johnson.
You are talking with a very angry lady. I am furious today. They had no right to market it. My message to people is drink water. You don't need aspartame in your life.
It's everywhere. Try walking down one aisle in the grocery store without finding aspartame in something. Is it safe? Should it have ever been approved? That all depends on who you ask.
What would you like to tell people about aspartame? Avoid it.
FDA representatives would not speak to us on camera, but they did send us this statement, and if the agency stands behind its decision. The statement then goes on to say the FDA remains ready to act if it receives what it considers to be credible scientific evidence. But until then, NutraSweet will remain on the shelves of your grocery store. Reporting live, Aline Sergani. Now back to you, Tracy.
Well, a very interesting report there, Aline. Thank you.
That was the end of that.
That's it.
Now, for more information, you can go to sweetpoison.com or aspartamesafety.com. I highly suggest you do that.
We just have 3 minutes.
Oh, good. Still drinking Coca-Cola? Watch this.
Ooh.
Let's see if we want to watch that. is our closing song.
Here we go.
All right. Good night, everyone.